Welcome to the afternoon session, where we'll be talking about concepts and language. But before we get started, we wanted to see, Your Holiness, whether you had any comments from this morning's session when we were discussing this issue of concepts and how it's put together both for Western science and for Buddhist science.
Nothing particular.
Go right ahead. All right. Well, then with that, I'll turn it over to Lera Boroditsky, who will be talking about language.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Language?
Yes.
Language?
Yes.
Of course, you see, what is it, the accent or pronunciation?
Yes.
You see, some cases very much related with tongue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the way develop sort of language. So at least, of course, basically same sort of human
yes.
physical.
Yes.
But in certain levels, some differences.
Yes.
Tongue.
Yes. And both.
So I'm wondering. For example, you say we Tibetan. Is it difficult to sort of use the word fa?
Yes.
So, I remember in early 50s, no, I think early 60s, when I met some sort of representative of different sort of European countries or America like that. So my translator, you see, he speaks English quite well, but when, like French, you see, this word come before he translate, he do like that.
He's getting himself ready.
Right.
So some Tibetan sort of word. Mm-hmm. You see, some other people, you see, it's very difficult to sort because of pronounce that.
Pronounce it. Oh.
So how much relations, language, and tongue?
And the tongue, actual physical tongue.
That's physical.
Yes.
So that's just, I'm wondering.
Curiosity.
Yes. Curiosity.
Thank you so much for having me here. I study how we're affected by the languages and cultures that we live in, so it's a special treat for me to be here at this confluence of two cultures meeting and trying to understand each other and grow together. So I often start by asking students in my classes what cognitive faculty they would most hate to lose. If you had to lose one thing that you can do with your mind, what would you most hate to lose? And often students will say, I would hate to lose my sense of sight, or I would hate to lose my sense of hearing. Once in a while, they'll say my sense of humor. But almost no one ever says, I would most hate to lose language. And yet, if you lost your sense of sight, or if you never had sight in the first place, or if you lost your sense of hearing, or you never had hearing in the first place, you would still have a very rich, wonderful human life. You could go to university, you could have friends, you could have a family, you could have a rich social life as a human. But what would life be like if you never learned a human language? Could you have a education? What would it mean to be here at the monastery? What would it mean to start a family? What would it be like to have any kind of job? People almost never say they would most hate to lose language because we take it for granted. It's so intrinsic to being human. It's so important to who we are. And yet it's like the air we breathe. We don't notice it. So So I want to start by showing some of the ways that languages around the world differ from one another. There are about 7,000 languages that people speak. And each one requires something different from their speakers. So let's consider this example. If I want to say, Tashi was born in the seventh blue tent. A simple sentence. And if you were... So languages will differ in what they require of their speakers to include in the sentence. For example, if you say this in English, you and this is something that happened in the past, then you would say was born, not will be born or is being born. In some languages, you would not change the sentence depending on tense. So in some languages, you would use the same sentence whether it's the past or the future. In some languages, there are.
근데 자세히 깨망부질이야 자세히 대배수다 마음배수다 다대배수 잡제 중원도 시계 시거래서 이내 깨그를 망부질이야 자외 수축이 수대 랑자샤제 자세히야 투육 교마다네.
In some languages, there are five different past tenses. So if this is something that happened just now, that's one way of saying it. If it happened a week ago, that's another way. If it happened 2 months ago, that's another way. You'd have to use a different form of the verb. In some languages, like in Russian, my native language, you would have to change the sentence depending on whether Tashi is male or female. In some languages, like in Tibetan, you would say it differently depending on whether this is something you witness yourself. If you were there and watched Tashi being born, you would say it one way. And if you didn't see it, you would say it a different way. In some languages, again, like in Tibetan, you would change the sentence depending on how important or honorable. So if it was Lama Tashi. So if it's Lama Tashi being born, you would use a different form. In some languages, you couldn't say the seventh blue tent because there are no words for numbers. So you would have to say there are some tents or several tents, but you couldn't say seven. Languages also differ in how they divide up colors. So in English, if we say it's the blue tent, we mean it's not the green one. But in some languages, blue and green are called by the same word, like in Tibetan, I'm told. And languages, of course, also divide up objects into different categories. So I'll start with the example that John Dunn gave us earlier of the idea of a pot. When you consider it from the point of view of one language, you might say, well, there's some things that are pots and there's some things that are pans, so there must be some kind of essence of pot, potness, some kind of essence of pan, panness. But if you look at another language, so for example, instead of English here, you look at Russian. Instead of pots and pans, you get one category that includes some of those objects, another category that includes other objects, and then the And then those other five objects all get five different names. So instead of two categories, you have seven categories, and they're just completely different from the English categories. And so these kinds of observations lead us to ask a lot of questions, like, do people who speak different languages think differently because of the languages they speak? Does learning new languages shape the way you think? So when you learn a new language, when you learn French, are you just learning a new way of expressing your thoughts? Or are you actually learning a new way of thinking? So is the language that you're learning actually shaping the very thoughts that you wish to express? Another question, do people who speak many languages, do they think differently depending on the language that they're speaking? So if you're speaking Tibetan or you're speaking English, Are you seeing the world the same way when you're speaking one or the other? Some people who speak several languages say they feel like a different person. So they say, when I'm speaking Russian, I feel like a different person than when I'm speaking English. Are there some thoughts that are unthinkable without language? So if your language doesn't have a word for it, or if you're a child just learning your language, you haven't quite mastered features of your language, are there some things that are beyond your imagination? And also, does language enrich cognition, or does it constrain cognition? So does it make us smarter, or does it make us more narrow in our thinking? So these questions have been being asked for a long time in many traditions, and I know these are questions that have been asked in the Tibetan tradition, as Jhumpa pointed out, but also in the West. People have been making claims about this for a long time. So here, Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne says, to have a second language is to have a second soul. One of his successors, Charles V, says, a man who knows four languages is worth four men. Very strong statement about the worth of a language. Frederick the Great of Prussia had a more specific set of hypotheses. He says, I speak English to my accountants, French to my ambassadors, Italian to my mistress, Latin to my god, and German to my horse. Not sure exactly how he came up with these hypotheses. But lots of people say things like this. They say French is the language of love, or German is the language of reason. There's no scientific evidence to suggest this is true, but people have these feelings about different languages.
The diplomatic word, some
treaties.
French language is best. I heard. The military matter, German language is more suitable. I don't know.
His Holiness has heard that, for drafting treatises between nations, mm-hmm. French language is best. And for anything that has to do with the military matters, the German language is best. So he's not sure, but he has heard.
So, but recently in cognitive science, this idea that language might shape the way we think actually became very unpopular. And lots of people argued that language doesn't shape thought, that everyone thinks the same way. One person that maybe put this most colorfully is Jerry Fodor. He's a philosopher, and he says, I hate relativism more than I hate anything else, excepting maybe fiberglass powerboats. He likes to go sailing, so he doesn't like those loud, noisy boats.
Sailing is like the truly a tarjeje, trutan lung te, trutan yajuba. That the jubje the fiberglass, because we have the Yawiosamarwa. There's a code, the government, in a tele manga or career slamna, the relativism, slap the tech, gay medawat on a misamdanaka or a skin shade, the cotan now to windows.
So, other than fiberglass powerboats, the real bane of his existence, the thing that he hates the most, is this idea that language might shape thinking. So in the last 20 years, researchers around the world have started doing experiments and asking questions. Is it really true that speakers of different languages think differently? To what extent does language shape thought? And I want to give you four examples. I'll start with how we see color. Languages divide the world of colors in a lot of different ways. So some languages have only two words for color. Some languages have many words for color, the way we have in English. And where languages put boundaries differs from one place to the next. Let me give you one example with Russian. So in Russian, things that are called blue in English are necessarily divided into two categories. The light blues are called голубой, and the dark blues are called синий. There's not a single...
The урсуке толя. Кузу рикчи и мангу зима чевече. Нгога де рика гаче. Нгона де дезинка гаче. Ларе. Is it a function of having more words to describe blue, or is it, I mean, are these two seen as two separate categories of color?
They function as two categories. Russian doesn't have a single word that can apply across the spectrum. So we can ask in an experiment.
Solon is wondering whether the environment makes a difference in terms of chopping up colors like this.
You see the winter, lot of snow. And sometimes you see the, because of
the sky,
the color of sky. I noticed, you see, the Hawaiian people, since they are, you see, their life is very much close with water, or the, I think, the weather. So they have a lot of word.
So, for example, because their life is very connected with the weather patterns, particularly due to the rains, they seem to have a lot more words to describe different kinds of rain, you know, very strong rain for a light rain and so on.
Because of their climate condition.
Their environment.
I don't know.
That's a very good question. So the question you're asking is, how much does our environment shape our language? And in turn, you can also ask, how much does the language that you're born into, the culture you're born into, shape the way that you think? And actually, we will answer the very question that you just asked in this experiment. So here we could ask, do Russian speakers actually perceive those shades of blue as being more different? Is it easier for them to perceptually distinguish those two shades of blue than English speakers? So here's the task that we give people. We show them three patches of color. One of the patches on the bottom is identical to the top. And all we ask them to do is say which of the bottom is the match. So press a button on the left if it's the left, press a button on the right if it's the right. And there are two kinds of trials, two kinds of situations. On the left, I'm showing a trial where the distractor color, the color that you're not going to choose, the one that's not the match, is from a different language category. On the right, I'm showing a trial where the distractor color, again, the one that's not the match, is from the same linguistic category. And so Russian speakers should be faster with the trial on the left than on the right. But for English speakers,
so you're Russian.
I was born in
born in
the Soviet Union. So for English speakers, these are all blue. So there should be no difference between one kind of situation and the other. So just to remind you, this is the task, a very simple perceptual task. And yet what we find is that Russian speakers are in fact faster when the two colors come from different categories for Russians than when they come from the same category. And English speakers don't show this effect at all. Now, you asked, Your Holiness, you asked a very good question. How do we know this has to do with language as opposed to other experience in the world that people have? So one way to find out if language is involved in the moment is to try to get people to stop using language internally and see if it changes how they think.
Say that again.
One way to find out if language is involved is to get people to stop using language and see if it changes how they think and how they perceive.
How do you stop asking them to use language?
The way we do it is with a task called verbal interference. So we give people a hard linguistic task. We ask them, for example, to recite numbers. So you say 7, 4, 3, 1, 6, and you're reciting these numbers while you're making judgments about the colors.
Right. temperature와 디카 주제 변에 처음 그 파트 이게 템프로와 다디 디카베야 안기코네 주버도 아니 안기직네 정화 주버도 당가 잡살샵에나 고 딩옴보레 딩옴보레 임레 마레시 임지타에 그 타녜기 옴보냐 바 타녜데 베주 제요 마로 로신다 질 때샤로와 다 디카블레야 아니 러시안 군주 단당 다시 옴보레 담다 임제 조고 땅토버데 나시 다도 용도고도 용고면도스 아야 고 타녜 장장 베주 제베이나 다 타녜 베주 제베 휴견 침부 테메나 아니 간다 타녜 베주 타녜로라 마차웨네 그
So if Russian speakers are seeing these colors differently because of the language that they have in their minds, if we get them to stop being able to use the language, this difference should disappear. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. When we ask people to look at these same colors while they're being occupied, while their language is being occupied, you no longer see a difference.
So that's you kuyu rang maimba. Kotanya peju chemaju bendugala, and then womburi nansu yemje tanto at the gema, doctanto banishing with tanto windows. It's quite.
Now, it's always important to ask this question. Maybe Russians are just weird. Maybe there's something else special about them. So it's important to do these experiments in lots of other languages. And in fact, when people have done the same kind of experiment, for example, across the blue-green boundary in English, you find the same results. People are faster to make distinctions across the boundary, and if you tie up their linguistic resources, that gets wiped out. Now, how could this be happening? This is such a simple perceptual task, and yet experience with language seems to be affecting even the way we perceive colors. How could this happen? Well, if you consider the way that color is processed in the brains, information starts with our eyeballs, it travels to the thalamus, which we talked about earlier. It stops first at the lateral geniculate nucleus. That's the first processing station for visual information. And then it goes back to the visual cortex and gets processed in one area after another after another. What you see is that information from the eyes actually constitutes only a...
cortex, Larry. Larry. So in your the visual cortex seems to have a kind of a quite an interesting shape. The upper part is broader and there's a stem. So in those people who have damaged that part, you know, depending on how large the damage and which part of the damage, does that affect the visual perception?
There's a certain shape, some connection with sort of mind or vision.
The shape of the visual cortex.
Shape.
Yeah. Does the shape have any significance for visual perception, or is it just like this?
Not particularly. Okay, I don't know if Lara wants to say anything different, but the shape itself, there's a lot of variation in the shape of the cortex. Pavan, do you want to say anything?
Sure. The visual cortex differs greatly across different people, and it doesn't really affect how well they are able to see. So my visual cortex could be much smaller than yours, and it would not make any difference in the richness of my color perception or my acuity.
Mi penzulia ya visual cortex chichung keba yores in ya digi genje je tong se masel shita keba yomares.
So in this processing stream, information from the eyes is actually only 10% of the input that goes into this first processing station. That's the bottom-up information that Richie was talking about
yesterday.
And the other 90% is coming top down from the cortex. So 90% of the input into this first processing area for visual information is actually coming from the rest of the mind.
When a visual perception occurs, the 10% of the content is really coming from the outside stimuli, and the remaining is coming from top down. Is that the?
This is in terms of connectivity. So the number of inputs that are coming into just that first processing center. So the visual processing stream will continue. It'll go to the cortex. It'll go to V1 and V2 and V4 and V8. It'll keep flowing. But even at that first instance, of even that first way station of processing, 90% of the inputs are coming from top down.
Top down.
So that allows for a lot of control from the rest of the cortex into visual perception. Okay. So next I want to talk about space and time, and I'll start with time. In English, the word time is actually the most frequent noun. People talk about time a whole lot. It's an object of fascination, and this is true in lots of languages. People talk about time a lot. But there's a paradox. There's a paradox here, because time is not something we can perceive directly. We can't see time, we can't smell time, we can't taste time, we can't touch time. And yet we talk about it all the time. How do we think about this part of our experience?
The five most frequent nouns. Is that true? I mean, is that?
Yes. It's been true for a long time.
So, to what extent that's, you know, that's a function of the statement, time is money and money is time?
It's mostly a function of the fact that in English, the word time is used in many different ways. So we can say, how many times has it happened? How much time do you have? What time is it? Those are all different uses of the word time. But because it's used in so many contexts, it becomes a very frequent word. But you can see
time pena ngaju chuzu gaju re slabena tu sikde peju chigu guyo maro pyogena. Inji kuzu, what time is it labdu gola? Time said the pejo chegurwa. The time said tick the pejo shukshimu shimu chegunyesh. So his holiness is wondering whether that is really a function of the English language or a particular need of a society, the way it's structured.
I think English speaking, for example, in England, I think some countryside removed may not consider time is very important. Even without a watch, they may, I think, use less word time. Then busy life in city, time then become very important.
Important.
So the circumstances, not language.
All I want to point out here is that we talk about time a whole lot. So words like year and day are also in the top five. And this pattern is true across a lot of languages. And my question is really, how do we think about time? One thing that's true... One thing that's true in a lot of languages is we use words that are spatial words to talk about time. So we say, the best is ahead of us, or the worst is behind us. Let's move the meeting forward, or winter is approaching. These are all words about space that we use to talk about time. They're metaphors.
Chos lab the dune, the gap down, the labdugal tati, Jidan to the way of Kitchen Imbachilla, Nizu Imbachilla, Chog, Tanya Pachachin with those, Ijinalo, the Shukchimuch. Then that to the Yahoo, the dune, they had a research, Yong Yuis. That to the Kanda Mesikib.
European countries, you see, winter quite cold, so you see, people, spring, Chitua.
Get excited.
I think like India, I think not much differences.
Okay, yes.
So, does the fact that we use these spatial words to talk about time mean that we actually think about time spatially? Do we actually think of ourselves as moving through time as if it were space?
I believe you see, I think the very basis of our existence is hope. So hope means future, forward.
Looking forward. The past is already gone.
So what you just did, Your Holiness, is very interesting. When you said the future, you pointed to the front, forward. And when you talked about the past, you pointed behind it. And so for a long time, people thought this had to be the case, that everyone thinks about the future is ahead and the past is behind, because, of course, we walk forwards, not backwards. We have eyes on the front of our heads, not behind. But it actually turns out there are people in the world who think the opposite. They put the past in front and the future behind. So one group like this is the Aymara. This is work by Rafael Nunez. The Aymara talk about the past as being in front of them, the future behind them. The reason being...
Where is this? Which area is this?
It's in Bolivia.
Bolivia, San Angelia. So that also sounds very logical, because what is past is in front of you. What is yet, it's already gone. Future you cannot see, so it's in the back.
So that's exactly the reason that's given, that the past has already happened, so you can see it, whereas the future is unknown, you can't see it.
Different viewpoint, yes.
So it's from different viewpoints, yeah.
So when the Aymara talk about time, when they talk about the past, they gesture in front, and when they talk about the future, they gesture behind. So the way they move their bodies even is changed by the metaphors. Now, another very common pattern for Americans is that time goes from left to right. So if I give you pictures of this apple and ask you, put them in the correct order, if I just scramble them and say, put them in the correct order. People who read and write from right to left, for example, Arabic or Hebrew, arrange the pictures in the opposite direction. They go from right to left. So this sometimes causes cultural confusion. For example, this This is a logo for a nutritional supplement for children that Nestle was selling. And you can, if you read it from left to right, it's clear what the product does. But when they put this in Arabic-speaking markets, it caused a lot of confusion, because if you read it from right to left...
So this is all, you know, concepts are playing games here. It's all concept based, yeah.
Of course.
So, you know, John talked about how we construct our concepts mm-hmm. and impose on the world.
Of course, time doesn't actually go from left to right or right to left. This is not reality, right?
True.
It's just entirely invented by our minds, by practices in our culture. But the way that we read and write also organizes how we imagine things unfolding. So, for example, in this study, people were...
Wondering whether the linguists have ever done any study on why certain systems of writing chose to write from left to right and others from right to left. I mean, what was the initial kind of impulse?
Yeah.
So it could be that the person who first invented the writing script of that particular language might be a lefty or right-handed.
Languages tend to adopt one direction or another depending on the writing.
So the Chinese is written top-down.
Mm-hmm. It depends on the writing instrument. So, for example, if you're chiseling in stone, you want to hold with your less good hand and use the hammer with your better hand. And if you're doing that, it's better to go in this direction. But if most people are right-handed and you're writing with ink, it's better to go from left to right because you're not smudging the ink as you're moving your hand. So you can see writing systems change one direction or the other depending on how the writing is being done, whether you're doing it in stone or you're doing it in ink.
I think Chinese language,
Since we're talking about language and the writing system, it turns out that the Chinese way of representing, you know, words doesn't seem to be based on alphabets. It's more of a pictogram. Mm-hmm. And then maybe the Egyptian hieroglyphs might be similar. But they are also ancient Persian language. Mm-hmm. Are they the same kind of pictogram type?
Ancient
Persian. Do we know? Egyptian the So in that sense, I mean, is there any rough idea of when alphabet-based grammar system emerged?
So writing systems in general are pretty new. Language, of course, is... We don't know exactly how old language is because it doesn't leave a trace, but at least 100,000 years, whereas writing systems are only a few thousand years. So in the scope of human history, all writing systems are very new. And there are lots of different kinds of alphabets. There are syllabaries, there are pictogram systems. These emerge at different times. So I just wanted to give you this one study. I love this study because it shows how the way we imagine events unfolding is also shaped by the writing system that we have. So here, people are asked, imagine that Bill is giving flowers to Mary. Draw a picture. And if, in this case, it was Italian speakers, but it could be English speakers, anyone who writes from left to right, if they're asked to do this, they'll draw Bill on the left and Mary on the right. But Arabic speakers will go in the opposite direction. They'll see Bill on the right and Mary on the left. So the way we even see events unfolding in our minds depends on how we're used to reading and writing.
Italian speaker Arab gyanyen da digiti kodon tigdos.
Now time doesn't just have to go horizontally from left to right or front back. It can also go vertically. So for example, in Mandarin, the last week is the up week, the next week is the down week, the past in general is above, the future is below. And when you look at the way Mandarin speakers gesture, or when you test them in experiments, you see that, in fact, they think about the past as being above and the future as below, in addition to other horizontal ways. Now, time, so far we've only talked about how time moves with respect to the body. So ahead of us, to the left, above. But time doesn't actually have to be organized with respect to the body. Now, let me give you this example. So I would like to ask everyone to close their eyes. So everyone in the hall, please close your eyes. Your Holiness also. I can see you, so I can tell whether or not you've closed your eyes. Okay, now without opening your eyes, point southeast. But no cheating, Your Holiness. Your eyes closed.
So it's also saying that this is being a new building. It's difficult to figure out where the southeast is.
Unless we go to outside, that's west.
It's more this direction. Yeah. Oh.
So I see points in lots of different directions. I saw points in this direction. I saw points in this direction, in that direction, over there. Junpa, you know. Southeast is in that direction. Now, there are some places where you could ask people this question, and...
So if you're outside, mm-hmm. when the sun is shining, depending upon the time, then you could pretty much guess which direction the sun is hitting your body, yeah.
There's some people are...
Sun, Lam, position of the sun.
Position of sun.
The sun can certainly help.
So even with your eyes closed, you can be pretty accurate.
Some people can be, but a lot of people, even when the sun is out, don't know which way is which. For example, we tested some students at Stanford University, very smart young people. We tested them outside, bright California sunshine. hills that are facing the ocean, a church that they're very familiar with. They can see everything. And only about a third of them could point north, south, east, and west correctly. And I really just mean within about 60 degrees of correct. The others didn't know which way was which. Even though you would think the sun would help them, they didn't think to do that. But there's some places where people are very, very good at staying oriented. There's one place that I have done research with in Aboriginal Australia. These are the Pomporau. And here, even a five-year-old child can tell you which way southeast is. So I can ask a girl, can you point north? And she'll point north without hesitating, without having to think about it. Now, why would this be? What could explain these this difference in...
Cultural heritage is make differences.
Make difference.
No building. Even no tent.
So they even don't have thatched homes.
Oh. So I think they very good.
So their sensitivity to the environment is very acute, because they don't live under a roofed environment.
So these folks do live in houses, but your Holiness, you're raising a really interesting hypothesis. And the hypothesis is this. Is it the case that if people live outside, or spend a lot of time outside, or can see the sun a lot, does that mean that they can stay oriented really well? Or if you find neighbors, so neighbors of these folks who also live outside a lot and also can see the sun a lot, but don't stay oriented, is there something about the culture and the language that they have that's creating the difference? And so when people have looked around the world, they find neighboring communities where one they live in the same place, very the same environment, and yet one group of people stays oriented really well and another one doesn't. And there's something that's very cool about the languages that these folks speak. These are languages that happen around the world. And that is, they don't use words like left and right to talk about direction. And instead, they use cardinal directions.
Which
part of Australia is this?
In Cape York, on the west coast of Cape York. In
west,
the north.
West past. So His Holiness recently visited the central part. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very poor. So one German voluntarily helping these native people education. Wonderful. I very much appreciate. And I also made some donation. These people, same human being, but without education. Very difficult, their life, very difficult. If we carry some investigation, genetically, any differences, I don't think any differences.
It's not just gonna, because the person on the left has so much beard. So he was wondering whether, how do they shave? Are they using knife or something?
Or just
So, Your Holiness, you're asking a very important question about education, which is we sometimes think about people who live in traditional societies as lacking access to knowledge, lacking access to education. But, of course, every culture contains a whole lot of knowledge and wisdom that's been passed down across generations. And one thing that's remarkable about these people and a lot of people like them is they have cognitive abilities that at least we in the West used to think were impossible for humans. They're able to do things with their minds. They're able to stay oriented in a way that we used to think humans can't do. So we knew that ants could orient really well, or salmon can orient really well, or birds. And we always had some excuse for why we couldn't do it. So we would say, well, salmon have magnets in their scales, or birds have magnets in their beaks, and we don't have beaks, and we don't have scales, so that's why we can't stay oriented. But these folks stay oriented so well just by paying attention, by always keeping track of which way they're going and keeping an active map in their mind. Now, one thing that they do in their language is they always use words like north, south, east, and west. For example, you would even say, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or move your cup to the north, northeast a little bit. I started... Now, I started out talking about how we think about time. And so what happens if you have a community like this that thinks about space with relation to the ground, not with respect to them? They don't use words like left and right. So I took pictures like this to Australia, and I would scramble them up, give you a stack, and say, put them in the correct order, lay them out in the correct order. So these happen to be pictures of my grandfather at different ages. And the way that I show them here is the way that an English speaker would put them out, from left to right. When I asked the cook... So when I asked the Cook Tire to organize these pictures, this is what happened. This is data from one person. They're sitting facing south. And all of these different arrangements are different card sets. So pictures of an apple being eaten, pictures of a house being built. And the numbers show the order. So all of these go from left to right. Now, this is the same person on a different day. They're sitting facing north. And now all of the cards go from right to left in the opposite direction. Here's...
La, Marita Kuzudi.
Right, in understanding that depending on which direction they are facing, they organize the photos differently, the
yes.
order.
That's one way of putting it. One way of putting it is to say, depending on which way they're facing, they organize the photos differently. But another way of putting it is, regardless of which way they're facing, time always goes in one direction, from east to west. It's for us that time always switches, right? If I'm facing this way, time goes in that direction. And if I'm facing this way, then time goes in this direction. Very egocentric of me to make time chase me around every time I turn my body. For them, time always goes in one direction, from east to west. As we establish that that's the east.
Is it advantageous? Does this system help them in ways that our system doesn't?
The question was whether the system is advantageous, whether it it helps people in ways that are... Every system has some advantages and some disadvantages. So certainly if you don't want to get lost in the woods, being oriented is really, really great. Learning left and right actually is quite difficult. So kids take a long time to learn left and right, and some adults still don't understand left and right. So each of these systems has different advantages and different disadvantages.
And I guess it's just that time goes in the direction of the sun, in other words.
In this culture, it's going in the direction of the sun from east to west, but that actually isn't the only way that it can go. So people have looked at other cultures that also organize space geographically. So one example I love is from the work of Rafael Nunez. He showed that in Yupno, time doesn't even go in a straight line. So time rolls down into the Yupno village, and then after it hits the village, it takes a turn and goes towards the mouth of the river. So it's a bent timeline that just happens to take a turn right in the village. Time can also go downriver in some languages. It can go uphill. So, for example, in Saltal, people will say, we have a lot of things to do still downhill of the party. So imagine moving in time as if you're walking uphill. Now, there are all these different ways of... that people have spatialized time. One thing we could ask is, how deeply rooted is time in our understanding of space? So if you damaged a part of the brain that represents a part of space, would it also disrupt the way you think about time? How related are they? Now, what I'm showing you here is a brain of a patient who's had a stroke in their right parietal lobe. This is a fairly common place to have a stroke. And when you... So as a result of this stroke, there's damage in the right side of the brain, in the parietal lobe. And people who have a stroke like this will sometimes end up in a condition where they neglect the left side of space. So the brain is organized so that the right side of the brain controls the left side of space. Now, what does that mean, that they neglect the left side of space? Well, in everyday life, people in this condition may only eat food on the right side of their plate. And they'll eat the food on the right side of their plate, and they'll complain they're still hungry. And then you can turn the plate for them, and they'll eat the food on the other side. Your Holiness, you asked about shaving. So people in this condition will, men in this condition will only shave the right side of their face. Women will put makeup only on the right side of their face. So this guy I've shown here is a member of a rock and roll band. He doesn't have this condition, but if he did, that's exactly how he would do his makeup. It even extends to how people draw. So, for example, on the bottom, I'm showing drawings of two patients who were asked to draw a clock. And you can see that one patient only drew the right side of the clock, and the other patient tried to fit everything in the clock into the right side. So there's an emptiness on the left. And what we wanted to know is, if you are missing the left side of space, are you also missing the left side of time? So if the two are so closely related, do you actually damage a representation of time when you damage space?
Yeah.
what we did is we told, we got these patients and we got healthy controls, and we told them about things that happened 10 years ago and things that will happen in 10 years. So things in the past and things in the future. 10 years ago, Tashi liked eating strawberries. In 10 years, Tashi will like eating grapes. So they learn about things that are associated with the past and the future, and then we tested their memory. Can you remember the things that were associated with the past? Can you remember the things that belong in the future? So first, let me show you data from the two control conditions. So we have patients who've had a stroke but don't have neglect, and we have healthy controls. And all the bars that go to the left are things that are associated with the past. All the bars that go to the right are things that are associated with the future. Both groups make some errors, but they're symmetrical. They're equally often right about the past and the future. When we tested patients who have left neglect, here's what they look like. Very skewed over to the right. So people who neglect the left side of space also couldn't remember things that were associated with the past, with the left side of their mental timeline. These patients were all Swiss, so they read and write from left to right, so their mental timeline was organized from left to right.
So would you see similar effects for people reading from right to left, but in a different region?
We're doing that study right now.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's an ongoing study. Excellent question. Here's one last way that languages can differ, and even within a language we can differ. We can talk about time as a path, a stationary path, that we travel from the past to the future. So we can say things like, we're approaching the deadline. We are moving. Time is stationary. Or we can talk about ourselves as stationary and time is moving. So we can say, the deadline is approaching. Holidays are coming. These are two very different ways of thinking about time. In lots of experiments, we've shown that these are conceptually different. And also, some languages have only one of these ways of talking. Some languages have both. Okay. Now, a key question, and this comes back to a question that Your Holiness keeps asking, is how do you know this is really about language? How do you know language is causing these differences? Right? Maybe it could be culture. Maybe it could be the environment that people live in. How do you know that it's the language that people speak that creates differences in how they think? And one way to answer that question is to change how people talk and see if that changes how they think. So that...
Change how people talk. And
so that's something we do in the lab. We bring people in and we teach them new ways of talking. So, for example, we might bring English speakers in and teach them Chinese metaphors for time. And then we can see, do they start thinking about time vertically like Chinese speakers do? And in fact, that turns out to be the case. When you teach people new ways of talking, it changes the way they think. So that tells us that at least influence can go from language to thought. When people change how they talk, it also changes the way they conceptualize these things. So to summarize this part, one reason that the way we think about time is so interesting is we construct our representation of time out of many different pieces. Time, of course, is not the only thing that's like this. There are many abstract ideas that we talk about. So whether we're talking about justice or love or compassion or truth, these are abstract ideas, right? And this is most of the stuff that interests us from day to day. This is the stuff that makes being human so much fun, right? So when you have a conversation with someone, if the only things you have to say is, this table is solid and wooden, if that's the only thing that you have to say, that's not a very interesting conversation. You're not going to get invited back to the dinner party, right? But if you can talk about time and truth and justice and beauty, these abstract things, this is what makes humans so smart. So what we've seen from our research is the way we build these abstract ideas is out of lots and lots of components. First, these ideas are deeply rooted in experience. So in the case of time, we conceptualize time as if it were spaced from our physical experience of space. But we also take a lot of cues from language and from culture, from metaphors in language, from artifacts like writing direction. And we're also constructing these ideas on the fly. So one way we are tempted to think is something like time, we have one big logical representation of time that always applies. But in fact, what we see in study after study is that people construct different representations, different concepts of time, depending on their goal, depending on the context. It's a very fluid construction. Okay. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is how we think about causality and agency and the extent to which humans are responsible for events.
Agency.
So I want to start with an old study. This is work by Beth Loftus. What she did is show people videos of accidents. So they would watch videos of car accidents. They would watch videos of car accidents, and then she would ask them questions about what had happened. And what she was interested in was, can you change what people remember about what they witnessed just by the way that you ask a question about it? So she was interested in how lawyers ask questions in court. And she thought maybe they could change the very memory that people have just by the way they ask the question. She would ask people, how fast were the cars going when they hit each other, or when they smashed into each other, or when they collided, or when they contacted each other? So she kept asking the question in different ways, using different verbs. And what's plotted here is how fast people thought the cars were going, depending on the verb that she used.
Smash chebe kable ya jolo ka jun dosun slaba ta kunye dong du yebe ka jolo ka zhe qin song en ji ge ji le xue be kable jolo ka zhe qin song ani ji ge ji tu be ka ju la zhe ga la di ta nie ka re be zhe ma zhe ge tuan ne mi zhe jolo de li ya ji wo dang ge de shi jolo ten ba de So the most accurate way is to check the speedometer and the language wouldn't come into the picture at all.
Our memory is very poor. It's very susceptible to influence. So in fact, when a week later she asked them, did you see any broken glass in the video? A third of the people who heard how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, said they saw broken glass. But there wasn't any broken glass in any of the videos. So they just incorrectly misremembered because of this vivid, crunchy verb, smashed. Now, you could ask, what's more important, the language that you use or the reality? So in the videos, she knew how fast the cars were actually going when they had the accident. And so here on the across the horizontal, I've plotted the actual speed that the cars were going. And what you see is that people's estimates had no relationship to the actual speed. So the language that she was using was much more powerful than the actual than the reality that people had seen. Now, any event that we want to talk about, no matter how simple, requires us to conceptualize it, to construe it. For example, a few years ago... So about a few years ago, then Vice President Dick Cheney went out hunting with his friend, Harry Whittington, and he accidentally shot Whittington in the face. Now, there are lots of ways that you could talk about this event, right? So this is, let me just say, this is a very simple event. It's an unfortunate event, but a very simple event. It takes only a split second, and it's a physical event. It's not like climate change, for example, or changes in the global economy that are very complex and have lots of causes. Shooting someone in the face doesn't take a lot of time, right? It's a very short event. But there are lots of ways that we can talk about it. So you can say, for example, Cheney shot Whittington. So very simple, direct sentence. Or you could say, Harry Whittington got shot by Cheney. So now Cheney is a little bit less responsible. Or you can just say Whittington got shot. Leave Cheney out of it.
So it's only to saying that it was not intentionally done. So that is also part of the event.
That's a wonderful observation. So some language...
So if someone says he shot him, but in English it's the same word is used. In Tibetan we have kind of, you know, intentional verb. Then ijna yomarwa. You can say intentionally shot. In English you will have to add that. In Tibetan, we have different...
This is a wonderful observation, Your Holiness. That's actually exactly what we wanted to study, is how people perceive events that are accidental depending on how they describe them. So actually, if we look at what Dick Cheney himself said in describing this event, he said...
So when
Dick Cheney was describing this event, he said, ultimately, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry.
Pull the trigger that fire.
So he takes this very simple event and makes it into four events. He says, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry. Right? So it's a split-second event, but he makes it into this long series of events. And then later he says...
<laughs>
요 말에 그 대체 잡다니야 중원시에서
This is actually something we do in language all the time. So whenever we pick a verb, we're saying how much time we're going to include in that verb. So I can say, we built Rome, one verb, or I can say, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry, just to describe that split-second event. We're taking a very specific perspective on time.
네, 네. In fact, there is a Tibetan saying which is, you know, the foliage of words obscure the kind of the reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, here's another example of that from George Bush. So he said he heard a bird flush. He turned and pulled the trigger, and saw his friend get wounded. So here,
So probably the best explanation would be. A mosquito landed on his finger. Accidentally.
This is some bodyguard who can take that.
Gun.
But then, oh, you see, mosquito publishes some social.
So his audience would tease the bodyguards who are carrying guns. Just make sure that when a mosquito bites you, you don't use the finger.
So I give these examples because here's one event, and yet we can describe it in all of these different ways. There are all of these different perspectives that language allows us to take. And languages differ in how they normally talk about events. So here's an example. You can imagine someone taking a mallet and smashing a vase intentionally, or someone accidentally backing into the vase. In both cases, the vase broke. And in English, you can say, Tashi broke the vase, whether it's intentional or it's accidental. In fact, in English, you even say things like, I broke my arm. Now, people mostly don't intend to break their arm, but in lots of languages, you can't put it that way. You can't say, I broke my arm, unless you're crazy, unless you went out looking to break your arm and you succeeded. Right, but in English, you can use that construction. You can say, I broke my arm.
So in Tibetan, distinctions are much finer. So you would use two different words. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's there. Cha.
So here, I can't read the Tibetan.
So His Holiness was referring to even the theory of karma. Mm-hmm. So there are certain actions that are unintentionally done. Mm-hmm. So although the act is done, but you don't accrue the karma because there was no intention. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you may have the intention, but you don't actually execute the action. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of a creation, there's no creation of karma, mm-hmm. because the act was not done. So you make these distinctions.
That's really interesting.
So Chinese act would be something that was done without accruing the karma. Mm-hmm.
So here's a question. If speakers of one language strongly distinguish between an intentional action and an accident, and speakers of another language in both cases say, he did it, he broke it, do they pay attention to the events the same? Do they think about the events the same? Do they remember the same things? So we studied this in Spanish. Spanish, like Tibetan, makes a difference, a stronger difference between intentional actions and accidental actions. So we showed people videos. They got to be witnesses to events. For example, you might see this intentional action. just like that, or an accidental version of it. Like that. And then we tested people's memory. We asked them, you saw earlier some guy with a balloon. Do you remember which guy it was? So that's a test of, do you remember who did it? Kind of like in a police lineup. You're an eyewitness. Do you remember who committed a crime against the balloon? In other studies, people have asked, do you remember if it was an accident? Do you remember if it was intentional or an accident? And here's what we find. If you ask, do you remember who did it? English speakers are better at remembering who did it if it's an accident. So they said he did it, they said he popped the balloon, and they remember who did it. But when you ask, do you remember if it was an accident, then Spanish speakers are better at remembering. So they distinguished in their language between things that were intentional and things that were accidental, and they also are better able to remember which one it was. So people who speak different languages can witness the same event, can look at exactly the same event and remember different things, pay attention to and remember different things, depending on the structure of their language, the way they would normally describe the event.
So Lara, just to be clear, so English speakers are better at picking out which person was the one who broke the balloon.
In the case of accidents, yeah.
In the case of accidents.
Mm-hmm. Because when it's an intentional action, both English and Spanish speakers will say, he did it, right? So it's not that Spanish speakers don't say he broke the vase when he really meant to do it. It's just that they don't mention the guy when it's an accident. So here we come back again to this question, Your Holiness, that you've raised. How do we know that language is creating these differences? Maybe there's some other cultural difference or some other difference in the environment that really makes this difference. And again, the way we can address this question in the lab is to change people's linguistic environment, change the way people talk, and see if that changes what they remember and what they can pay attention to. So the way we do this in the lab is we bring in English speakers and we bombard them with language that's either what they're used to, like he blew out the match, he burnt the toast, he unfastened the necklace, or we give them the other version, the match blew out, the toast burned, the necklace unfastened. So one group gets surrounded by agentive language, he did it, he did it, he did it. The other group gets, it happened, it happened, it happened. And then we show them the same videos of people popping balloons and breaking vases, and we ask, do you remember who did it? And what we find is people who just heard, he did it, he did it, he did it, pay more attention to and remember better who did it. But if they hear the match blew out, the toast burned, the necklace unfastened, then their memory for who did it goes down. So we can change the way people talk or the language that they hear and change what they attend to and what they remember. Now, another question to ask is, does this affect how we blame people and how much we punish them? So this maybe comes back to the question of karma and whether or not karma is accrued. Of course, in the West, we only think about money. So instead of asking about karma, we asked how much should the guy have to pay for the damage that he caused. So we show people videos of an accident, and we describe it for them, saying either something like, he broke the vase, or the vase broke. Now, they see the same video either way. So everyone sees the same video, but what we find is people who heard he broke the vase want to charge the guy a lot more, 53% more in fines if they hear he broke the
vase. Let him. So, of course, we have to assume that he did not mean to do it intentionally, because otherwise you could push with your behind as well. So, Dirishan, then the Inji Tsinalo Tsikchima de Omarwa, Medugal Ku, he broke it, Labada, and then Pumba Chansons, Labanig, Perchu, Chema Jagatone, and so that means for legal matters, you know, using Tibetan is a good strategy.
It's much more precise. Tibetan is more precise than English in this way. There are languages that make even more precise distinction. I don't know about Tibetan, but I can give you an example from Divehi. This is a language spoken in the Maldives. Take the example of Romeo drank the poison. So if someone intends to drink poison, picks up a glass of poison, drinks it down, as opposed to Caesar drank the poison. So Caesar thinks he's drinking wine, but someone has poisoned his drink. So he intends to drink what he's drinking, but he doesn't know that it's poison. As opposed to Socrates drank the poison, where he knows he's drinking the poison, but he's being forced to do it. He's not doing it voluntarily. So in English, those are all, he drank the poison, he drank the poison, he drank the poison. All the same sentence. But in Divehi, those are three different, you have to use three different constructions. Verbs. So they care whether you're being forced to do it, whether you're doing it knowingly, or whether you're doing it without your knowledge. Okay. Now, of course, languages also talk about people and divide people into categories. And here there's been actually relatively less research, but potentially there's a lot more impact that we should think about. So I just want to bring up a couple of cases. One way that languages divide people is in terms of honorifics, right? So in Tibetan, of course, you refer to people in different ways depending on where they are and their position in society. In lots of languages, in Russian, my native language, if you want to address someone formally, that's a different word for you than if you want to address someone informally. We have a special pronoun in English for Your Holiness, where Your Holiness is the only person who is addressed as Your Holiness. It's a very, very special pronoun in the English language. In some languages, even the word for I changes depending on who you're addressing. For example, in Thai, if I'm talking to someone higher than me in status, I use a different word for I than if I'm talking lower.
The best thing is one time in Moscow, the university, they invited me. I went there. Then the IT chancellor of that university called me, Mr. Dalai Lama, come. Yeah, that's very good, best, I think. I think the wonderful thing is, many years ago, I received one, the box, cigars. From Cuba.
Cigars.
Mm-hmm. From Cuba. To Mr. and Mrs. Dalai Lama.
Well, I hope you didn't have to share them. Of course, languages also divide people by gender, right? So in some languages, the way you talk about someone, you say he as opposed to she. In some languages, even the word for you is gendered. So if I'm addressing a man, the word for you is different than if I'm addressing a woman. And some languages don't make gender distinctions. And some languages don't make gender distinctions at all. They use the same pronouns for men and women. And there's new research coming out of economics labs, actually, where economists have looked across lots of countries and asked, does how much you distinguish between people by gender predict how fair the culture is in terms of pay for women, in terms of education for women, in terms of roles in government for women. And they're finding correlations.
What do you mean by no gender distinction in pronouns?
So
they don't use he, she?
Yeah, there's some languages where there's just one third-person pronoun that's a generic pronoun that doesn't distinguish between he and she. So this research is quite new, and people are still...
That's my curiosity. I was told one small island in the Pacific, you see, in their community, the mother is the most important.
It's matriarchal. Matriarchy. No?
So they, you see, consider female is more sort of respected, like that. So how it developed, I don't know. My curiosity. I think we need some research, how it developed.
There are a few matriarchal cultures still around. There, for example, the Nazhi in China, near Lijiang in China, are a matriarchal culture. Women hold the property and they hold the power. And in the Nazhi language, you can see this reflected. For example, if you take the word. For example, in Nazhi, if you take the word for rock and put a feminine marker on it, it becomes a boulder. But if you put a masculine marker on it, it becomes a pebble. Okay, so we started with all of these questions, and I just want to quickly revisit them. We asked whether people who speak different languages think differently, and there have been lots of examples. I just showed you a few examples, but there's a rich body of research saying that, yes, in fact, they do. And learning new ways of talking can change the way you think. So when you learn a new language, you're not just learning a new way of expressing the thoughts that you already have. You're actually learning a new way of seeing the world, a new way of conceptualizing it. I didn't talk a lot about bilinguals, people who speak multiple languages, but there's a lot of research showing that depending on the language you're thinking in the moment, you might see the world differently. You might remember things differently. You might make judgments differently, depending on what language you're using.
The statement that languages, you know, different languages make us think differently, maybe a little bit too generalized, too broad, because there may be a layer at which, due to the cultural and environmental differences and different needs of the community, we use different languages and think differently at that level. But at a fundamental level, you know, the human beings are human beings. They are basic needs, basic desires, and also, you know...
And in different languages, it makes a difference.
So when it comes to basic emotions like, you know, anger, hostility, attachment, craving, and all of this, you know, at that fundamental level, the different languages, His Holiness does not...
If language really makes differences, then Richard Davidson, I think, should carry more research work. Different people, different language, where the differences in the brain. No differences, I don't think.
There has been a lot of research on how people who speak different languages think. And of course, here I've shown you a lot of differences in behavior, but behavior arises from the brain, right? So if people remember different things, if they make different judgments, that has to come from the brain. So for me as a scientist, the question is, what evidence would we have to say that language doesn't matter or language does matter? And what I've shown you here is a lot of cases where if you change the language, it changes how people behave and how they think. So that's the kind of way that a scientist would ask this question.
His Holiness's point was that clearly what you have shown is that it has an effect, but it is at a certain level. But at a very fundamental level, there would be shared kind of, aspirations, shared emotions that are universal, that would, connect all of us as basic humans.
So to me...
biological factor, I don't think any differences.
Much difference, yeah.
The cultural aspect and a certain way of life, there are different language, really makes differences, I think.
Well,
you know better. You are specialist. I'm not specialist.
Well, to me, these are empirical questions. These are questions to be answered with experiments, right? So if the hypothesis is, at a fundamental level, we're not different, my question would be, how would we show that that's true? Or how would we find out that that's not true? So what are the studies that we would have to do to really ask that question in a scientific way? Because for me, it's not enough to say, it feels like we're all the same, or it feels like we're different. I want to actually look at data. And so when we look at data, looking at how people imagine the world, how they remember the world, how they make judgments, we see lots and lots of differences, even in the domain of emotions, which Your Holiness has mentioned. So...
Yes,
and let me just wrap up.
Go ahead.
Okay. We're running low on time. Now, one thought that people had originally is that language and thought are essentially the same thing. And so asking whether language shapes thought doesn't even make sense because they're essentially the same thing. Another idea might be that language and thought are two separate things. And then you can ask, does the way we think influence the way we talk, or does the way we talk influence the way we think? But I actually think neither of these things are correct. Language and thought are neither the same thing nor two separate things. Now, what I mean by this is not something very mystical, but just that what goes into thinking are lots of different kinds of representations. So we have representations in our minds that have nothing to do with language. They're non-linguistic. We have representations...
Non-linguistic, like you call it. Dala matembe. Tung kichiru with them. Yung chukur bas. Dala tzal duba meba. Dala tuyishabek. Tung kichiru. Lari. Dene did the non-linguistic chagwa. The non-linguistic chagwa. The theories were more. Theories. It's a kid, Togony with the Chibuchiya Maris, and the Tachi to Tade Maris. That's true. That's true. Because His Holiness was giving the example of very early, very young infant, before they're able to speak, they can recognize their mother. Mm-hmm. So they have some kind of concept, but that's not linguistic.
We also have representations that are linguistic. They might be words or sentences that are floating around in our mind.
But we also have
a third kind, which is representations that are not words or sentences. They're not linguistic in their form, but they've been formed by experience with language. So because of our past experience speaking a language, learning to speak our particular languages, we've constructed representations in a particular way. And so in the ecosystem of thought,
just
what goes...
Just out of curiosity, what example would you give there?
An example would be when I talked about time. So the way that we construct time as being spatially vertical or horizontal, that's a spatial representation. But you wouldn't have made it that way unless you'd had your experience with language. So to wrap up, a whole lot of what we perceive as reality is instead cultural heritage. It's ideas that we get from our culture and from our language. Now, our cultures make us incredibly smart. We inherit a lot of ideas from our ancestors. So much of the way we see the world is because of the thinking that people before us have done. But on the one hand, cultures make us very smart, but on the other hand, they reduce cognitive entropy. What I mean by that...
Entropy is what you call it.
Science field. I think because research is difficult, but
also, you know, sophistication of the language makes a difference because language gets more enriched as it is exposed to more ideas. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Tibetan language, for example, after Buddhist ideas were imported from India, the language became enriched and then it, you know, kind of developed much more resources to convey certain ideas. So there's also kind of a lot more active processes that goes on.
Yes, that's true. And when
in the field of science, you know, new discoveries lead to coining new words, which then opens up new ideas and concepts and so on.
Whenever people,
so for example, sometimes when you find a new discovery in science, and if you are not able to have a creative way of describing what that is, then sometimes people just use the name of the finder, like Bell's theorem. Just give the name of the discoverer.
Whenever we develop new knowledge, we also develop new language, and the two play together. So language creates new knowledge, and new knowledge also creates new language. So while cultures make us much smarter than we would be otherwise, they also reduce the number of paths that our mind travel. Cultures carve deep grooves for our minds to travel, and when we're stuck inside one of those trenches, we don't think to look outside and think, how could we think differently? Could this be different from the way that I'm doing it now? And that's one reason I really like looking across cultures, looking at other languages, because when you see how things could be different, that's actually a way of understanding yourself, understanding how you came to be the way that you are, why you see the world the way that it is. With that, I want to thank you, Your Holiness. It's been an honor. I want to thank you for your attention. It's been an honor. I did not convince you, but you've given me a lot more things to work on.
Well, Thank you very much for that, Lara, and thank you, Your Holiness, for your attention and your good questions. I'm not sure that we have time for discussion. We have like 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, if some of the fellow presenters have 1 or 2 questions,
well,
then we can end.
Yeah. But what I'm thinking, for example, is that part of what Kathy Kerr was talking about would relate immediately to some of the things that Lara was talking about. You don't want to worry about that?
No, I don't think we need to worry about that.
Okay. And what about you, John, in terms of the issue of valid cognition and relativizing valid cognition?
I think that one of the very interesting questions is exactly, in some ways, that has come up here is, to what extent can we talk about human universals? And in one way of thinking about that is that human, when we construct the category of human universals, we can allow there to be variability within that category and still have a universal. So even though there may be some variability that we can observe across individuals or across cultures, in terms of some of the fundamental questions about wishing to be happy and not wishing to suffer, some of that actually, the variability may not be relevant to addressing in practical ways some of that. So that's also an interesting question. Do conceptions of happiness and pain and suffering vary sufficiently across cultures that we really need to think of these in different ways? Mm-hmm. Or is the very, and this is similar to the Buddhist theory that when we make the concept of a glass, all glasses don't need to be different in order for us to functionally treat them as the same. When we talk about humans, all humans don't need to be different in order for us to think of them in certain ways as being the same. So I'm wondering whether that might be a way sort of to bridge these positions.
Sure. Well, so let me talk about the idea that everyone wants to be.
Sorry.
So let me just address this idea that everyone wants to be happy. Of course, in America, everyone wants to be happy, and not just happy, but like excited and overjoyed, right? That's the normal way to want to feel. And I always used to joke that in Russia, people didn't want to feel happy. They wanted to feel a melancholy, because only an idiot could be happy in this world, right? If you were happy, it meant that you couldn't understand the world the way it really was. And for a long time, I thought that was just a joke. But actually, people have started doing research showing that, in fact, Russians do want to feel melancholy. They don't want to feel the kind of happiness that Americans want. So even this idea of what's positive or what's desired, I think, is subject to interpretation. People want to feel in different ways, depending on what's seen as normal in their culture.
Right. It's true. Yeah, Jay.
Well, I think that that's an interesting example. I would want to know a lot more, though, about what melancholy really means for a Russian, and whether it may relate to a sense of being calm and being less bombarded by stimuli, a desire to somehow escape from the situation in which they reside. But the word melancholy, I think all emotion words have so much surplus meaning. And so I think in this realm particularly, we need converging measures.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe Darashatana Morangi.
Is that okay?
Just a small thing, like in India and Nepal, when we address to a woman, depending on their age, we'll speak as mother, elder sister, or younger sister, any stranger. same for the males. And about this morning, about what Cathy said, Your Holiness mentioned that maybe if we have compassion or something, it might decrease the feeling of pain. So we did that with Tanya Singer, an experiment where one time you receive the pain, other time the other person receives the pain, and you have to think either with empathy or something. So in my case, I tried to think that when I was receiving the electric shock, I was imagining the other one was my kind mother, and I was rejoicing that it was me and not her. And then we noticed that the pain, the perception of the unpleasantness of the pain will decrease very, very much. So because of, in a way, being happy to receive it instead of somebody else. Mm-hmm. And one last thing about the effect of the mind attitude, we did a completely reversed experiment where remembering some pain feeling that went with Richie, sort of burning pain, I was imagining, without any physical pain, a strong burning pain on the wrist, and it would activate the pain network in the brain to some extent, yes.
Mm. Can I just want to take that really quickly. No. I think there were in Lira's... I just wanted to say that in Lyra's talk, the thalamus also appeared, and there was an example of perception that was modulated by a lot of other input from the brain. And what this suggests is that context, culture, language, and attention are all going to have a role in modulating something that we think of as very, very natural. So I thought that that was a theme that went across both talks.
Right.
So can I ask,
Of course.
One of the things, I'll be very brief. Thank you for all the very detailed evidence showing the differences in the way in which we think. But the basic facts are that biologically, you know, we have all these sensory faculties, and these sensory faculties are very similar across human beings, regardless of whatever language we use. So clearly, logically, one would expect these sensory faculties in the brains that we have will exert certain constraints of a shared universality to the human species. And then even looking at the examples that you gave, you know, whether we speak of time this way or that way, front or back, essentially, people are using concept of time and space. That seems to be another constraint. So, you know, why can't we argue that there are certain constraints? You know, it may be manifested in many different ways, but these are what, you know, establish a certain universality.
There. So I don't want to give the wrong impression. It's very clear that there's a lot of things in common across all humans. And the reason to look across languages and cultures is not to say that they're different, but to understand how we build the knowledge that we have in the first place. What are the mechanisms by which we come to think the way that we do? We all make the error of thinking that we see reality.
That's true.
That when we look out, we see the world the way it is, but in fact, we have constructed it. And so what this work is trying to do is say, what are the mechanisms by which we construct it? What is the role of culture? What is the role of language? What is the role of the body? What is the role of experience? And all of these things play a role. So there are definitely a lot of inputs that are coming into our ideas, but the most important thing to take away is that we're not thinking about the world the way that it is. Okay. We're not seeing reality. We're constructing it from a whole lot of ingredients.
Sure.
And the point is not that we're so different. Sure. It's that we're engaging in this very active process of construction.
Thank you.
And Jim Pala.
La, tanati tadebe namsha mangbu yine. Tanati mitadeba ge tadege tone tadan ka samdan na kagayu gurus modubje mangbu koyurwa. retene tawe milia leba ta wang po ta tikiti ta ke ta me ta kar ja be ne chang ma chik bor ju yo be ndu ga la ti cha ne yu zin dan le ya cha chung ba chi ten de le gu gur bas tu cha sha be ne tu dun da gya ta kar la be ne tu na cho gi ta nye je ma che ba sam no je ma dang ba la yu ri be cha ba na le tu mi do bas ti ki ti cha chung ma re be ta mo ran sa ne ga de ma re sa ne ga de ma ju tu ju nyamnyong to ne chi yu thong yong de ga la ti thong ba ti yu chi ta wa shin da ma ju 통구도 삼점지 나와 샤르게 얼어서 단 디템바 말에 가서 들려야 아니 수수께다 르슝다 망부지 차진 거 돈에 아니 수수 용어디 아니 유치다와 신도 차와 많이 봐 유디 유디 땡도 똑배 쥐네 눈배 자샤버지 된대지 세브르샤스
Well, obviously this is a rich vein for discussion. Thank you, everyone. And we will continue tomorrow. I have three announcements to make. First, to remind everyone that we will have the Q&A starting at 3:30. Second, this morning His Holiness visited the exhibition on climate change, and everyone is invited to go visit that. It's a fantastic exhibition and really worth seeing. It's open from 4 to 9 today, Wednesday, and Thursday, and it's held over in the Sarah J. Science Center. And then lastly, we'd also like to draw everyone's attention to the second exhibit that you visited today, Your Holiness, which is the exhibit on water that is at the secondary school. And I think if we see that, we can be so excited about what young people can do when they take on a topic creatively. So we invite everyone to do that. And lastly, we thank Your Holiness for your time and attention.